thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. And PLA is a very important organization, and so whatever I can do to help out, I want to help out with. So good afternoon, good morning. We're around the world. So hi to everyone. Thanks for coming. And really, I would love to see questions and things as we go. I want to make sure that this presentation is as useful to folks as possible, and that usually means as much interaction as possible. So I have some prepared remarks, but if we go left or right or center, that's okay too. Not a problem at all. Now, if you're anything like me and you look at this title, you probably have the first reaction like I did, which looks a lot like this, hopefully. Post-recession library? Right? I mean, let's face it, this is not just the golden era of library funding we're going through. I mean, if you're anything like me, either you know someone who's been laid off, you know someone who's about to get laid off or on furloughs, or you're worried yourself that it's going to happen. This is really dark budgeting times, and I don't want to in any way minimize the fact that we're feeling a lot of pain at this point in the U.S. I mean, you know, we've been salvaged a little bit from when the crisis started in 2000, 2007, 2008 in the fact that we've had federal funding, we've had, you know, delayed budget kick-ins, we've had, you know, the money was already collected and we've been spending it out, but we're feeling the pain now, even though we're sort of past technically the recession. And we're to the point of beginning a recovery. We're only beginning to feel the pain right now in libraries, at the state library, at the local library, at the system library level. And so I don't want to in any way feel like we're minimizing this. What I really do want to focus on is, you know, not the new normal as many people talk about. You know, we could have an entire discussion about how to do more with less. And frankly, there's not much more we can do, and, you know, less is going to be less. This isn't an idea of how do we get used to being funded at such low levels. This is not going to – I don't want to have a discussion about, you know, how horrible it is out there. Let's just acknowledge it and then think about how can we prepare so that we don't get in this situation, or how can we take advantage of the fact that, you know, this recession has really changed the consciousness about public libraries with the public. And I think that right now there are some opportunities there that we can look at, but we need to be prepared for them. We need to figure out how we're going to utilize those opportunities, and we don't want to waste what silver linings we've managed to find. So if you were doing a search around the idea of public library usage, and this search was done about a year and a half ago, and you just did a general Google search, you'd find something that looks remarkably like this. And the language goes, you know, there were Katie Kirk on the nightly news and Brian Williams on the news, and we got CNN stories and you got local stories, and they all went around the idea of, God, the economy sucks, and so people are going to the library. They're going because, look, they have free DVDs. I mean, it just amazes me to this day that, you know, it was like 2 years ago, Oprah Winfrey was sitting there saying, can you believe you can get DVDs at the library? And you're like, hello, where have you been? We really put out the idea that we know you're hurting, we know it's too expensive, come to us and we can help you, right? We're the alternative way, we're the way that when you're unemployed or you don't have additional resources, this is when the public library really comes and is useful. And it's absolutely true. And so story after story, article after article, piece after piece was sitting there talking about the wonders of the public library, and it was delightful and amazing. And, you know, the good news is, it worked. So here's some general public library usage. This is from the state of Iowa. And we see things like checkouts go boom right through the roof, right? We can look at Iowa public library visits. So not only were they checking things out and then, you know, getting them through the mail, they were actually coming in and using it. So we looked at these numbers and we thought these are amazing numbers. What I thought was really interesting, though, is when you look at these numbers, it's missing a bar, sort of hidden the graph, because the truth is, this is a trend that didn't start in 2007, right? This is a chart that when, you know, the venture capitalists and the bankers of Wall Street blew up the world, this rise began. These charts actually start in 1998. What we have seen, and I'm sure the recession has accelerated that curve a bit towards the end, but we got to remember that actually increasing public library usage, circulation, all sorts of statistics, electronic use of statistics, all that data is showing that library usage has been going up well over a decade. This number goes even farther back. And there's a potential, and by the way, this is Iowa, this is Michigan, You know, it's hard to find a state where this wasn't true. Massachusetts was going through this. We were seeing a huge bump and increase in usage of public libraries well before the economic catastrophe that we're in the middle of now. And, you know, we sort of said that, but no one really noticed. And we really said that when the recession kicked in. One of the things that I bring up, and I keep harping on this issue, is that we also need to worry about the message that we put out. In this huge increase, in this idea when people were saying, go to the library, and people were coming to the library, we were making an argument that said, you know, you're having to cut back at home, you can't use all the resources that you used to do through Amazon or what have you, come to the library. The scary thing is that that message, if you're not careful, quickly translates into the public library as Walmart. That we have to be careful that this is a message that I want to be really careful that if we continue to make it, we have to understand what we're saying, which is, you know, well, gee, so when you get your job back and when you start making money again and when the economy picks up, go ahead and go back to whatever you were doing before, even though we know they were still using libraries. We're just the least common, you know, we're the lowest cost provider. I don't think that's a message that in a post-recession era we want to continue. You know, do we really want to look at the public library as the place where you can get free DVDs because you could afford them on Netflix before, but now you can't? And you know, it's a message that's dangerous. It sort of talks about us as we're here when things are really bad, but when things are good, go enjoy yourself. We don't want to do that. What we need to do is when we're thinking about and working forward in as the recovery comes about, we need to position ourselves so that we can utilize the fact that we have brought new people into the library. We have brought new members on board. We've shown them new values. We've introduced them to things they never knew existed. So we need to benefit from the attention. We just need to make sure as we control the message that that message doesn't come back to in bad times you need us, in good times you don't. Because in the truth is, in bad times, you desperately need us, and in good times, we can help it make it better, is a much more interesting message, and I think one that we can really look at selling. So the new rhetoric that I've seen libraries use isn't this low-cost provider, isn't the fact that, you know, we know you really want to go to somewhere else, but you'll come to us because you can't afford it. You really want to talk about, well, what is the safety net that we're really providing? And I have to say, I've been extraordinarily heartened by the rhetoric that's coming out now, the messaging, the marketing, and really the service and our commitments coming out, which is, you know what? You need us because, you know, there's vital stuff that we're providing. Right now, as libraries are hurting, we know that all sectors of society are hurting. One of the tough parts, if you will, of being a library professor at this point is that I'm teaching new library students, and they come in and they say, Dave, will there be a job here? You know, can someone hire me? And the answer is, because libraries are so diversified, there are lots of places that, yes, you know, one, geographically, things are hit differently. The academic sector is coming back a little faster now than, say, the public library sector, the government sector, for-profit sector, all these different sectors that utilize libraries. But we still have to talk about the vital service that we can provide. Right? And so one of the things that I've seen in this language goes back and forth, which is don't just come to us because you can't afford to go to the movies on Friday night. We need to provide a vital service back to our communities. And right now, that language is around jobs and employment and economic development. So you see service after service, which is now geared towards helping people find jobs, helping people find new employment, helping people get back to work. And we're going to talk a little bit about how that message is going, but I see sites like this all the time, people building portals around resources, people putting up new information about resources, and I think that that's a message that has some currency right now. I think it's a powerful message. I think it's a message that talks directly to our communities about how we can be of direct benefit and something that they really care about. But I also want to be cautious about this message as we move forward, which is, a lot of what we're talking about is come to the library to search for a job. But oftentimes, when we provide information, we don't necessarily serve all their needs. That simply providing access to monster.com on a website is not enough. We really need to deal with the fact that we're dealing with a whole person here. right? We need to deal with the idea that when someone comes in, it's not just that they may be unprepared to use the tools we've put together, in which we always sort of said, we can do that, we can help you, we can help you find a job. We also need to understand that we need the community to understand that we do feel their pain and that we understand that they're a complete person, not just someone looking for a job. I'm reminded of a story, Marty Reed, who's the state librarian of Vermont, told this story where she was at the library and a gentleman came up and said, you know, you look so familiar. He said, you know what? You saved my life. And she said, well, great. How did I do that? He goes, you know, 10 years ago, I was out of a job and I went to the library to find resources. And what you did was you set up, you had a break room and you took the break room and you cleared it out and you put a coffee machine in. And so every day I could come and I could sit down and I could have coffee and other people would come in and they were looking for a job and they could sit down and suddenly I felt like I wasn't alone. That it wasn't enough to come in and search for the job. It was to come in and feel like a valuable person again, to have a community, that I could have something that I could dress up to go to. That the library providing to me not simply the resources, but the empathy that I need. And so one of the things that I would encourage you to look at is as you're building information, as you're building these resources, as you're building web portals, as you're building all these things, don't forget that you also need to be human, that you need to truly understand that community. You need to look into that community, and you need to find how you can serve it. Now, this is not just me saying this. Barbara Stripling is the director of school libraries for New York City. And she's doing a study on school libraries and how school libraries can help people learn. And what she found was that one of the most vital things that people need to know, particularly when they're studying history and such, is empathy. That if you try and teach someone, if you try and help someone, if you try and provide a new skill to someone, you need to help them develop empathy to truly move from knowing something to understanding something. Now, I know that sounds really pie in the sky and way up in the air, and what does that mean? What she found in a very real way is that she looked at an English classroom, she looked at a social studies classroom, and she looked at a school library. What she found was that students would not go to the school library because when they did, all they got was a series of resources and look at this and look at that and look at this and look at that. And when they went into the classrooms, what they got was, well, what do you think? What's going on? How can I help you? And I know we look at service, we say, well, we're service-oriented. But service-oriented is different than being resource-oriented. If we define service as providing resources to people, read, spitting resources at people, we are going to lose them. We must provide understanding and empathy. We must provide speakers. We must provide a place. We must provide respect. We must provide opportunities for them to share their expertise. I'll give you a quick example of how that might be happening. In Syracuse and I'm sure many different places, people have to apply for jobs online. And they have to apply for all the jobs online. And so what was happening is that people were coming to the public library and they were applying for custodial positions, positions that required in no way any technical skills. And yet they were required to apply online. Now, step one of providing a resource is saying, hey, no problem, come to the library, we have computers and we can walk you through the application process. And by the way, not only were these, one of the reasons these employers were moving to an online system was not just to help their own workflow, it was also the fact that they would every so often see when you got timed out. And they would set the time out at different lengths of time because they actually used that as part of the evaluation. So if it took you a long time to fill out the custodial application, you wouldn't get hired. It would be factored into the decision. What these librarians did, which I just thought was brilliant, was not simply here's the computer, how to use it. Not even training on how to use the computer. They would then pick up the phone every time, call the HR service of the local company and say, do you realize that you're asking people to apply online for jobs that don't require online? In essence, they became advocates to these folks. And so the idea is that what we need to look at in a post-recession library or in a recovery library is that our communities are hurting. We understand that they're hurting. We have resources to help. But even more importantly, we are committed to help them. what can we do in an advocacy mode back to these folks, right? Can we present to these large corporations and employers statistics of the number of people who are coming in for these jobs? Can we present them what technical hurdles they found? Because we're going to them not as someone saying, I want my job and you won't let me. We're going to them as saying, our community's in pain. Here are the obstacles that are in their way. How can we solve this together? Can we set up training sessions so your HR folks can come into our library to talk to these potential people who are looking for jobs? That's a radically different role than unemployment's high. Let's go find a bunch of unemployment resources. So what I would like you to think about as we move into this sort of post-recession library where people are coming into on huge numbers is how can we treat them as people, as members? Simple things like coffee pots and meeting rooms, larger things like sessions and work, but understand that you're really teaching these folks. In order to help them, you must understand them as a whole person and not simply their information need and their information problem. I'll give you a few other examples of how the employment thing can play out. This is the Free Library of Philadelphia. And within the Free Library of Philadelphia, we started talking about to the business community, how can the library help the business community? And we were meeting with venture capitalists and people from large corporations, and they all looked at us and they said, you can't. Thanks anyway. Oh, I'm sorry. You know, if we stopped the conversation there, it would have been very depressing. But luckily, we waited two seconds. And they said, but when I started my business, the public library was vital. Right? So here were people that were now in charge of very large corporations and when they started. And they said, you know, when I was starting, I had this great idea. And I couldn't do it within my organization. I couldn't do it because, one, they'd own it. Two, they'd know I was thinking about leaving. Three, they didn't have the resources. Whatever it was. And so where did I do? I went to the public library. They had million-dollar databases I could get to, but they had a place and they had an area to work in. And so what the public library needs to do to support business and economic development is to help people start businesses. You know, we do a lot of things where we look at public libraries as providing business resources. How much do we do in sort of starting business resources? You know, we talk a lot about helping people find jobs. How much do we do in helping people create jobs? And that's something that we need to think about, I think, a lot more deeply. We treat jobs as if they're this commodity that we buy and trade and move around. And the truth is, we really want to find people's passions and find a way that they can make a living at it. And that's sort of interesting. So what we were proposing is something called the Entrepreneurium, where we would create a center that looked a little more like, you know, FedEx Kinko's than looked like the business reading room. People would come in cohorts. We could prepare, not only do lectures about how to start businesses and bring in accountants and lawyers and venture capitalists for people to hear and pitch ideas to. We'd also do field trips. So people would meet in the library. We'd go to local startup companies, whether it was the butcher on the corner or whether it was a large startup. And we'd say, what did it take to start this and how did you do it? And so going outside of the library to this expertise, we could begin to really generate ideas on how do we create businesses. Now, you're saying, oh, great, Dave, Free Library of Philadelphia. They're in a large urban area. They got lots of people to go around. I'm in fill in the blank here. One-person library, 10-person library, rural, suburban, what have you. Well, this is where there's a cool story. I'm also part of a project called I Lead You, which is out of the state of Illinois, where we do it's sort of an immersion exercise for a year where we talk about technology and leadership. And this is the, I believe it's Emporia. No, it's not Emporia. Eureka Library in Illinois, right? And Eureka, Illinois, in southern Illinois, is about as rural as you get. And so what they started doing is they said, you know, we want to support business leadership. And what happens, as happens everywhere, is Illinois started cutting back on their job support systems. And they started cutting back on how much they could put out for to help employment. And so they were closing offices. And some of the folks came over and said from the employment office and said, well, we got to close the office. And they said, well, can you stay? Because we can give you a room. We can give you a table back there. And, in fact, what happened is they then co-located the resources for employment options in the public library. They started getting a little rent money, which was hilarious. So they actually gained money by doing this. And the other thing that happened is the woman in the apron in this image, she came into the library one day and said, you know, there's no place to eat lunch around here. It's not a good lunch place. Not a lot of anything here, but certainly not a good lunch place. And she goes, turns out I'm a trained chef. And I have an FDA-approved sort of kitchen that I can do. Would you mind if I made lunch around here? And the librarian, to their credit, said, absolutely, we'd love it. Here's the corner of our facility. Here's the corner of our yard. Set up there, and every day, every Thursday, I think it was, they would set up, and she would set up lunch for everyone. And it got so popular that eventually it was like a couple of days. And then it turned into catering opportunities. And so the way the library facilitated entrepreneurship and startup is they actually supported it. They didn't give her a book about it. They didn't talk about it. They didn't say, well, here's a webcast about it. They said, here's a place. Let's do it. How many of those are in your community right now? How many people are doing scrapbooking? How many people are doing knitting? How many people are doing computer programming and coding? How many people are doing consulting? And how many of them right now are going to be coming into your library so they can hang out around that coffee urn because they're looking for the next position? We have another library here. They every month they have a discussion on Civil War history, and they bring this fellow who comes and talks about Civil War history, and he's actually a warehouse worker in a local Home Depot. But for one day a month, he's the Civil War historian who loves it and gets to use it, and suddenly everyone's coming in, and they started a community, and they started a discussion, and he gets much more fulfillment from that than necessarily what his day job is. And maybe, someday that'll turn into another job or another career. It's these kinds of opportunities that we can provide, and really, one-on-one, every so often, that we can really begin to look at how can the public library help the community develop and improve? Finding jobs is important, but finding your passion may be much more important. Finding resources to support your passion, the most important thing yet. What are we doing to serve that need? There's no book we can buy on that. There's no material that we can provide. That really is us talking to folks. So exploring empathy, exploring career opportunities by doing. And really thinking about whole new creatives that we can be entrepreneurial as well. We need to model this. So the idea is, you know, I told this line to a good friend of mine once. I said, you know, librarians should help people create, you know, quit their job and create a new one. And he looked back at me and he said, how many librarians do you know quit their job to start a whole new business? And, probably not as many as I would like. But then again, we could say this of neighbors and friends and all these other things. So if we're not ready to quit our jobs today to model this behavior, we can at least be much more entrepreneurial and innovative within our libraries. So this is a story you've probably heard a lot about. And Sari Feldman, who's like one of my favorite human beings in the whole world, is the director of the Cuyahoga County Public Library outside of Cleveland, Ohio, I believe a former PLA president. And she tells the story about how, due to economic downturns, they were having to cut Sunday hours at many of the branches. And she was at a session where she found out that you can, right now, if you want a passport, you can go to the post office, give them $50, a picture, fill out some paperwork, and off it goes. She found out it doesn't have to be a post office. In fact, once you're certified and registered to do it, you can do it anywhere. So guess what she did? She took, like, the remaining public libraries that were open on a Sunday. She set up a passport processing center there, and what happens is they made enough money at keeping the fees and such for that processing and serving a real need within their community that eventually they could open up Sunday hours at all the other branches. That's an entrepreneurial idea, right? The passport, it fits the community. It fits a community need. It's not a commercialization or a sellout of that community, and yet it's something entrepreneurial and something new and something that we can look at creating new revenue sources in order to support what we're doing. I talked to another friend of mine who moved from being director of a library to being part of a library consortium. And he said, it's very interesting now. He said, my job now is that I've got to go out and get customers, and I've got to get people to buy in. He said, most of my library career has been about spending budgets. Here's the money that the city, the state, whatever gives us, and my job is to spend it. Spend as close to it as possible and not go over. He says, now I'm in a position where I've got to earn it. He says, it's a very different mindset. So when we look at our budgets in this recession world that we're in, and hopefully post-recession world we've been in, we need to consider that the money that we're going to be bringing in may not always come from the taxpayers, or may not come directly from the taxpayers. We need to look at other ways of doing this. And another example, I should stop here. Are there any questions that I can jump on, or do you want to just keep going and we'll get them later? Okay. So let me give you another example, and then I'll sort of bring this together. The Onondaga County Historical Society, right? So you think that libraries have budget problems, go to a historical society. The Onondaga County Historical Society, a couple of years ago said, we are not going to depend on any public funding anymore. We just can't depend on it. We just don't know if it's coming. We don't know how often. In fact, not to pick on Syracuse, but our symphony just stopped operations last night because we didn't have any more money to continue it. And this is probably not a story that's unusual in other places. So they said, forget it. We just can't do it. What can we do? And they created a program, a very interesting partnership with the local theater, Syracuse Stage, professional theater company. And they said, what we're going to do is we're going to, every play that you bring in, we're going to identify some linkage to our local community. In their case, historical linkage. In our case, it could be historical, it could be current, it could be future. And what we're going to do is this historical society went through their collections, and so currently the Miracle Worker is what's being offered. And so they went back and they found that we have, you know, this whole interesting background in helping people with disabilities and helping people with hearing impairment and all of this information. And they found resources and materials. And what they then would do is they'd go find a corporate sponsor, and the corporate sponsor would create a display so that when you went to the Miracle Worker, when you went to the Playhouse, as you were waiting to go in, as you were sort of milling about, you saw this rather amazing display about how this area tied into the theme of the play, sponsored by local bank, whatever it is. And then what would happen is after the run of the play, they would take that same exhibition and they would then rotate it around libraries around the area. So they would continue the conversation going, and next play coming in, the library would be talking about what's coming up, and it created this sort of virtuous circle where the library was supporting the historical society, was supporting the theater, was supporting the corporate backers, and it was going back and forth. And now they don't require any additional funding from sort of public sources. They're being sponsored in sort of an old way. But it took them thinking differently. The other story, which I love, this is one of the most amazing stories, I think, that I've been witness to. This is the Homepage Cafe, also down at the Free Library of Philadelphia. And the Homepage Cafe is interesting because it is, remarkably, a cafe in the middle of the downtown library, right? So the central library, right in the urban core of Philadelphia. And what they did is they said, all right, we're going to open a cafe. Yay, very exciting. But they didn't, we'll get to why and specifically, because they weren't actually trying to solve the problem of people needing croissants in the library. So what they did is they said, we want to do this. And the first thing they did is they got a corporate sponsor to help with the architecture and build it in. Now, they had, once again, nice banks down before the crash. And so the corporate sponsor kicked in, built things. Then they said, well, we need coffee. They got Starbucks to provide the equipment and the training. And then they said, we're going to sell pastries. And rather than being in competition with our community, they found a local baker within the community who had their own shop and now could provide food here as well. And so they actually boosted the local community that way. And then this is the most important one. This problem they were really reaching out to solve wasn't, as I said, croissants in the library. It was homelessness. They had a huge homeless population in urban core Philadelphia. And so the last partnership, actually the first one they made, that's what I'm going to tell you about, was with a group called Project Home, which is a homelessness to work transition organization. All the folks who manned, who were employed to service the Homepage Cafe, were folks in this transition service. And so they were literally pulling themselves out of homelessness. And so this kind of amazing partnership and entrepreneurship and service to the community, they don't create this diametrically opposed thing. They show that entrepreneurship is something that really works well. So what I want to just say is that we have right now, once again, not ignoring the pain that we're in, but looking at the positives of the situation we're in, we have a pretty potent combination of things that we can capitalize upon. People are coming into our facilities. They're utilizing our website. They are thinking about the public library like they never have before. We've gotten press attention. People know the library. We have services that we can offer, and these services go beyond simply here's the collection, here's the material, but really these whole person services, this idea that we can provide not only a true community place, a place to come and be a community, a place to come and feel worthy, a place to come and share ideas. We have that, which is unlike any other business out there. I mean, if you talk to someone and said, what do you want to do? We want to create a physical presence facility that's highly trusted by their communities in every community and hamlet in this country. You couldn't do it, and yet that's what we have in public libraries today. And we have this ability and these models that we can look at about being innovative within what we do and helping foster other people being innovative. This combination, the people to do it, the community buy-in, and a quest and a strong belief in innovation is an amazing recipe for success. This is the opportunities that we have. But notice that the opportunities that we have are not about our collection, and it's not about our book budget. Right? Those things may be important, but I would tell you are absolutely secondary to what we really want to do, our real mission. Our real mission is not to warehouse and collect materials and things. Our real mission is not to just sit here as a building and have people come in and be quiet and all this. Our real mission, the mission of every librarian, is to improve society through facilitating knowledge creation in their communities. Why you are there is to make it better. The reason that a library exists within a community is not to warehouse, not to provide materials. It is not to promote literacy even. It's to do whatever it takes to make that community better. And, very importantly, in a very particular way, which is around knowledge. Now, I know some of you may, when you hear that word knowledge, instantly think nonfiction, academia, learning math and stuff. But that's not what I mean. There's knowledge of the self. There's knowledge of self-worth. There's knowledge of where we fit in a larger society. There's philosophy and fiction and entertainment, all fitting around knowledge. What we have and the message that we need to put out is not that we're the cheap Barnes & Noble. It's not even the fact that we can get you on monster.com. It's that all of these services are really just our way of trying to help this community make better decisions about how we spend dwindling resources, better decisions about how we treat those who are has and have nots, better decisions about how we educate, better decisions about where we put tax policy and economic development. The most vital things that our community is trying to wrestle with is how we make decisions about very, very hard issues. And a public library is there to help you with the issues. We belong in the boardrooms to help you make better business strategy. We belong in City Hall to help you make better tax strategy. We belong in the schools to help do better education. And we're going to partner with librarians and with business and with government, all of these sections, so that we can help you build knowledge. We can help you make better decisions. So ultimately, what I believe, looking at this mission, looking at the community, looking at the focus, what I believe looking forward is that the best days of librarianship are ahead of us. Now, I said that once in a big room, and someone literally in the front room, and this was like a year ago, someone literally in the front row looked at me and went, loudly, you've got to be kidding. But no, the best days of librarianship are ahead of us. We are the right profession and uniquely positioned to lead in a knowledge age. Think about it. Everything we're talking about is the advance of technology, the advance of the service operation, the advance of knowledge culture, the advance of entrepreneurship, the advance of communities and their knowledge. Who else can walk through the halls of government and walk through the halls of corporation and walk through the halls of the homeless and be considered someone who can be trusted and deliver that information? Who else is professionally trained, distributed around the country, around the world, to take advantage of these resources? This is our time. But to take advantage of this post-recession age, to take advantage of this new normal, to take advantage of the people coming into our doors, it's not going to be our collections, but our communities that ensure that future. So when I do have those library science students come and ask me, is there a job? Am I going to be employed? Where are we going to go from here? I said, go out and find out. I said, you know, look, we're not going to avoid this. We're not going to pretend that nothing's happened. Go out and find out. So I sent library science students through the literature, through the news. I sent them calling, and I said, tell me what the state of libraries are like right now. And we had a very frank discussion about that, and we need to. And you know what they found? They said, you know, it's tough. We see libraries closing. We see libraries being threatened to close. We see zeroed out budgets. We see, you know, people in the federal Congress talking about cutting LSDA funds. We see lots of that. But the other thing that every time we found that depressing news, we found this. We found that every time a library was threatened, people stood up. The people of the community stood up. The people of the communities were so invested in their library that they shouted and for the first time became involved and active. Now, I don't know about where you live, but right now I have a major borders closing. I've seen lots of borders closing, right? They're scaling back. I see lots of signs around these places, and they all look things like 30% off and 40% off and come get it now. But I never see a sign that says, don't let it go. When a Blockbuster closes, people don't ticket. When someone threatens to close Barnes & Noble, if it comes to that point, people are not going to line up out of the door and chain themselves in the room, into the building to prevent it from being closed. And yet, that is happening in public library after public library after public library. The future of the public library and the real value that we get for all this pain is that we get this. We get 11-year-olds sending email and $11 of their own allowance to keep us up. They get people who won't let us close. This is our value. And this value doesn't come from the number of resources we put on a web page, and it doesn't come from how cheap we are with the latest Danielle Steele book, and it doesn't come from simply being a place that people can go because they can't go anywhere else. It comes from the fact that we believe and love this community and show value to this community every day, and they're starting to show it back. So the way we get through a post-recession library is not to entrench ourselves and just say, oh, my God, you can't afford e-books and HarperCollins is going to let you who cares what HarperCollins wants to do? If you want to boycott HarperCollins, make sure that your community is willing to do it, too, because you got to see they need to feel your pain as well. What we can do is if we use this as a chance to reconnect with our community. I just saw a note about not every community, there are some communities that vote to close. It's true. How can we show them what it means to close us? How can we show them, how can we make sure that if they threaten us, all these folks are going to stand up for us? The best advocates that we have for renewed funding, for continued existence, are not ourselves. They're the people and the stories that we can tell of those people making better decisions and having better lives.